Welcome back to the Hemingway List. Oh, I better hold the keyboard. Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Hope this microphone is sounding okay. I know it's still broken. I don't know what to do about it. I gotta try some things. I keep meaning to try some things to fix it during the day, and then I forget, and then at night I just keep doing the old touch the keyboard while I talk thing. Anyway, today we're talking about Book 5, Chapter 4, Part 2, and then we'll be reading Part 1 of Chapter 5. Chapter 5 was really long, it was like 16 pages or something, so we're definitely going to be breaking that one up. Now, my little theory that I had, I don't know if you guys remember this, but I remember saying that when we break up the chapters into smaller sections, we get more conversation. Remember me saying that? And I just want to point out that if I look through the last few chapters, okay, so Book 4, Chapter 5, 18 comments, Book 4, Chapter 6, 15 comments, Chapter 7, 9 comments, Chapter 1, 20 comments, Chapter 2, 13, Chapter 3, 24, and then Chapter 4 I broke into halves, so Chapter 4, Part 1, 33 comments. Alright, so that's nearly 10 more than the next highest, 9 more comments, and then Part 2 is 36 comments. Coincidence? Probably. In fact, I know a lot of the comments on the previous one were people saying their little commiserations towards me, saying I hope you feel better, so you can probably delete about 6 of the, you can probably reduce that number by about 6 or something, but still. That is still, even with that, more comments than the next highest. And I just thought it interesting that the 2 days in a row where we went, where we broke the chapter up, we got, like, I don't know, something like 20 or 30% more conversation. Okay, the questions that I asked you guys about Part 2 were these. Ivan doesn't even believe in avenging murderers. What is the ultimate point Ivan is trying to make? And general discussion. Those are all very general questions, except for the first one, which I think I might have got that wrong. Anyway, we'll find out soon. Summer Stars says, Ivan doesn't even believe in avenging murderers. I think Ivan does believe in avenging murderers. He was just trying to get Alyosha to say he felt the same way, because to do so would be to violate certain religious foundations. For number two, what's his ultimate point? I had to read the chapter a couple of times to figure this out. Oh, you poor thing. It felt like a lot of dark, angry rambling. Ivan states his goal at the end, though. He says that he is saying all of this to test Alyosha's beliefs because Ivan wants Alyosha for himself and wants to save Alyosha from Zossima and Z's teachings by challenging Alyosha, using examples of humans at some of their darkest moments. He hopes to poke holes in Alyosha's religious education. And general conversation. I had read someplace back when we started the book that Dosto intended to challenge everyone's beliefs. If you are an atheist, this book should challenge you. If you are a religious zealot, the book should challenge you. For the religious, this should be a hard chapter. It should challenge you. What about if you're agnostic with a strong dose of apathy? I'm agnostic not because I can't make up my mind. It's because I don't really care for the religious conversation or the anti-religious conversation, which might be why I'm so not enjoying this book. Just doesn't interest me anymore. It did for a long time, and I think for a long time I was sort of something like an atheist or an agnostic who was trying to figure it out, going through the motions and learning about different religions and learning about their counter-arguments and it did interest me for a little while when I was like a young man, but now it's just apathy. Like, I just don't enjoy the discourse anymore, which I know that kind of maybe puts me in a bit of the minority because it's just one of those things people can talk about forever. But I'm the same with politics as well. Like, politics is one of those things that people, it's a never-ending conversation, but for me it's just not even a conversation. Like, I just, I don't know, can't be bothered. Probably says more about me than anything else. Maybe I'm some kind of anti-intellectual or Maybe I'm just truly apathetic. But anyway, Somastar says, one thing I was ruminating on was Ivan's use of the word forgiveness. In his argument, he seems to conflate forgiveness and reconciliation, which are two different things. To forgive means you don't hold a grudge, you let go of your anger, but it doesn't mean you forget what has happened or reconcile with those who have done wrong. It's possible to forgive someone, but also be aware of who they are as a person and not be a doormat for their poor behaviours. As Maya Angelou once said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. Forgiveness also does not mean that person escapes being held accountable for their actions, whether that's in the social or legal realms. When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. What a beautiful thing. What a beautiful little sentence that is. Should have that written on my eyeballs, so I never stop reading it. Techrific said, God moves in mysterious ways. That is the usual response to Ivan's charge against God. All the tears will be wiped in the end, and all will be explained in the afterlife. Just trust in God's plan. Well, that's precisely what Ivan can't do. He thinks God is a cruel God that created us sick and then demands us to be good. To Anders' first question, what Ivan rejects is the idea that a mother, in essence, is asked to forgive the man that set his dog upon her child. Turn the other cheek, so to speak. God will deal with all this in the end time. Either you believe children are born innocent or you don't. If you believe in original sin, then I guess you square this in your mind. So much for those children that are Christians and live in Christian lands like Russia. But how about all the children born into other religions or no religion at all? How do we explain why non-Christian children in the heart of Borneo in Asia, or indigenous tribal children in the Brazilian part of the Amazon, suffering at the cruelty of God's creation, case in point, the larvae that eats into children's eyes in those parts, as just part of God's plan? To add insult to injury, those children will never see paradise since they're not Christian, not baptized, nor ever heard of Jesus or gotten a chance to accept him. According to Catholic doctrine, a pedophile priest, if he repents and makes the right propitiations, will go to heaven. What is it? Action of appeasing a god or spirit or person. Cool word. If they do that right, they'll go to heaven. But not those children. No, it's straight to hell with them. That should also answer Anders' second question. It's absurd and unjust. It's absurd that people can square these things and still consider themselves moral and just. I'm sorry if I offend any of you, our religious posters or lurkers, but this kind of thinking should be thought of as obscene. At least I have respect for those Christians that do take it seriously and try to do missionary work in Borneo and in the Amazon in order to reach some of those children before they die. But those Christians sitting at home praying to God to help them with their house and lives and children, what can be going on in their minds? I can only think that they haven't considered the actual consequences of this doctrine. Yeah, well said. It's also worth remembering that Christianity is stupid. It's a stupid, stupid thing. Swim said the mum of fish, he said. Well, as a lapsed Catholic, I would say I'm offended, but I don't think the brush you are using to paint with is a tad broad. Sorry, I do think that the brush you are using to paint with is a tad broad. It's not so broad compared to my statement that I just made. None of what you are stating is what I believe or how I personally live my life, nor is it what I was taught by the nuns and priests of my youth. So on behalf of the religious posters and lurkers, your statements are a disservice to those who define themselves as Christian, yet do not subscribe to what you're espousing. Lapsed Catholic. There's a definition of that there. What is a lapsed Catholic? It's a baptized Catholic who is non-practicing. Such a person may still identify as Catholic and remains Catholic according to canon law. Oh God, there's a whole... This thread... Okay. Alright. That's a lot of arguing, guys. That's a lot of back and forth. I'm just going to keep scrolling down here. It's probably all very interesting. But I'm going to skip that back and forth because I can see that there's a little bit of, religious debate. Which, you know, let's be honest, there's going to be enough of that going on in the book. Swim said the mama fish, he said, "My understanding is that Dostoevsky struggled with faith and doubt, so it is no wonder this is a central theme of the book. From my readings, it appears that Dostoevsky was raised in a strict and abusive Orthodox household, became a passionate intellectual, very similar to Ivan, and ended up in a horrific Siberian prison camp with only the Gospels for reading material. I agree with Somestar that our beliefs all cross the spectrum should be challenged, and I think that was Dostoevsky's intent. I certainly have been examining what my own beliefs truly are. A book that refined my belief, published in 2001, was Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God by Jack Miles from the New Yorker Review by James Wood. One of the many peculiarities of religion is that, like the Hoover vacuum salesman and his celebrated packet of dirt, it offers to solve problems that it created in the first place. Take the problem of evil. In a world not created by God. In a world not created by God. The fact that people suffer must merely take its part in a team of other inexplicables. But in a world created by God, evil must have been created too, either by God or by forces opposed to God. Evil becomes a problem, an affront to God, which is solved only by our cleaving more strongly to God, who is goodness. In a sense, God is then what Cardinal Newman called the Catholic Church, a great remedy for a great evil. But is evil the problem or God? Oh, that was my phone. Ignore that. But is evil the problem or God? This is the dark question that crouches blasphemously in the Bible, in the punishment of Adam and Eve for committing a sin that only God himself could have made possible. In the divine injunction that Abraham sacrifices his son Isaac, in the lamentations of the psalmist and Job, and on in this is a long comment, and I'm already, to be honest, I'm just reading words. Sorry, Swim said the mama fishy. Should I go back? Because I'm not paying attention anymore. In a sense, okay, I'll go back, because you've put a lot of effort into this. In a sense, God is then what Cardinal Newman called the Catholic Church, a great remedy to a great evil. But is the evil the problem or God? Is the question, dark question, that crouches blasphemously in the Bible. In the punishment of Adam and Eve for committing a sin that only God himself could have made possible, in the divine injunction that Abraham sacrifices his son Isaac, in the lamentation of the psalmist and Job, and on into the New Testament, accumulating in Jesus' cry of abandonment on the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The Bible is an anthology of human incomprehension. God made his covenant with Abraham, but then, over the next couple of thousand years, his chosen people found themselves slaves in Egypt, exiles in Babylon, the colonized subjects in their own lands under Roman occupation. The Messiah, the Jewish leader, and the prophets who said would conquer all foreign nations and subject them to Israel's sovereignty, had conspicuously failed to appear. The most inventive solution to the failure of the old covenant is Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, who comes from God and who is God, who takes upon himself the sins of the world, and who also allows himself to be sacrificed, thereby cleansing the world of its sin. Jesus Christ is the great cure for a great sickness. In Christian doctrine, particularly in the visions of Paul and John, Jesus is God made briefly human. This is called the incarnation, and he is the announcement of a new covenant, not with Israel alone, but with the whole earth. For Paul, Jesus was the second Adam, the corrector of Adam's original sin, for as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. So Jack Miles is quite right in his new book, Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God, to suggest a little blasphemously that the story of the New Testament is the story of a self-rescue, a rescue by God from a calamity that God had created. God had cursed his own creation in Eden after Adam's sin, and was now lifting that curse, or at least allowing for the possibility of remission. The world is a great crime, and someone must be made to pay for it, Miles writes. Mythologically read, the New Testament is the story of how someone, the right someone, does pay for it. In its broadest outlines, the story of the Bible is the story of how God first turned his blessings of fertility and dominion into curses and then turned his curses back into blessings. Stamostar said, I had read somewhere that Dostoy died with a renewed belief in the teachings of the Orthodox Church. He did bounce around in his beliefs, but ultimately returned to religion. All pretty interesting. I like... What was this bit I liked? Just thinking about Jesus as a real person here. And taking on the sin of the world. And then being sacrificed. And cleansing the world of its sin. Nice thing. A lot of cult leaders will use like parlor tricks to trick people into believing that they are somehow greater than a human. Yeah, like some of them even use like little smoke machines and lighting effects and things like that to seem otherworldly. And I like to think that Jesus was just a guy who used some parlor tricks to trick people into being like, wow, he's magic, he must be a god. He can walk on water and do, what's that healing that they do when it's like you basically just get a bunch of endorphins to happen and then they can briefly feel a bit better. That kind of thing. Quackery. Convinced everyone he was God. And then did a big sacrifice of himself. But what would his life story be like if it was just a big ruse that he did selflessly for the good of mankind? And it worked. Thousands of years later, we're still like, yeah, that dude was really a god. And now we feel good about ourselves. That would be a cool story. I'd read that. Jesus the charlatan. The most benevolent charlatan ever. He tricked everyone so that they might be a little bit happier. In every man, of course, a demon lies hidden, says I Am Norwegian, of course, quoting Nietzsche. It's no wonder people ask if Dostoevsky has read Nietzsche. Oh wait, was that a quote of Nietzsche or did I mix that up? I saw the word Nietzsche and assumed that... Okay, that was a quote from the chapter we just read. In every man, of course, a demon lies hidden. It's no wonder people ask if Dostoevsky had read Nietzsche. That makes sense, doesn't it? Yes. Question 2. Ivan doesn't even... Oh, that was question 1. Ivan doesn't even believe in avenging murderers. I think the point Ivan is trying to make that it doesn't matter if you avenge the murderers or torturers of children. What good can hell do since those children have already been tortured? In the world of adult men, we have bitten the apple, and it is a different case to the innocence of children, where the suffering cannot in any way be atoned for. Ivan's terrible stories describe these situations where no justice can be found, where harmony cannot be restored. It cannot be made right, even with the existence of heaven and hell. Well, you could avenge the children to make the case that, you know, if you murder kids, to all the other people watching, because I'm assuming there was a crew of people in that scene, that you will immediately also be killed by someone who is watching nearby and wants to avenge the children. And it won't bring the kids back, it won't equalize anything, but it might stop it from happening again by some kind of onlooker who saw it and was like, oh, cool, evil, I might do some evil. Question 2. What is the ultimate point Ivan is trying to make? Ivan is trying to explain his worldview to Alyosha. His worldview is sort of existentialist. There are things which he cannot understand, and what he can understand, he cannot accept. Here is Robert Solomon explaining what existentialism is. Existentialism is an attitude that recognizes the unresolvable confusion of the human world, yet resists the all-too-human temptation to resolve the confusion by grasping toward whatever appears or can be made to appear firm and familiar. The existential attitude begins with a disorientated individual facing a confused world that he cannot accept. So yet he resists the temptation to try to resolve it. So he just exists within that confusion, accepting that he does not and cannot know. Right? I don't know. Does this sound like Ivan? Kind of, yeah. This is my favorite chapter so far. says I am Norwegian. Ivan here reminds me so much of the unnamed man in Notes from the Underground, but Ivan here makes a much more emotional case than the Underground man ever did, and without the disregard and apathy towards humanity. After a few minutes of reading, I feel like I sometimes do after watching a 2-hour-long emotionally gripping drama. Uncle Jossel Mayer said, trying to avoid spoilers, I think that until now, this book is about absent and unfitted fathers and neglected sons and daughters. No wonder why the constant questioning about the existence, the authority and cruelty of God and religious institutions, this chapter was superlative and thought-provoking, adds Swimsed the Mofishi. Superlative means of the highest quality or degree. Right, it certainly has some shock value to it. And slowly wound its way around a point, which it got to eventually, which was something existentialism. Alright, we're going to read the first half of The Grand Inquisitor, the chapter called The Grand Inquisitor. It's quite a long chapter, actually. Let me just double check. We're going to read up to the point that says, the deception will be our suffering, for we shall be forced to lie. That deception shall be our suffering, for we shall be forced to lie. Okay, that's the last line of what we're going to read today. The rest of it goes a little bit like this. Chapter 5, The Grand Inquisitor. Even this must have a preface, that is, a literary preface. Preface? Preface, laughed Ivan, and I'm a poor hand at making one. I'm sure you'll give it a good go, Ivan. How many pages of preface are you going to do? You see, my action takes place in the 16th century. And at that time, as you probably learned at school, it was customary in poetry to bring down heavenly powers on earth, not to speak of Dante in France. Clerks, as well as the monks in the monasteries, used to give regular performances in which the Madonna, the saints, the angels, Christ, and God himself were brought on the stage. In those days it was done all in simplicity. In Victor Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris, an edifying and gratuitous spectacle was provided for the people in the Hotel de Ville of Paris, in the region of Louis the 11th, in honour of the birth of the Dauphin. It was called Le Bon Jugement de l'Etre Saint et Gracieux Vierge Marie. And she appears herself on the stage and pronounces her bon jugement. Good judgment. Something, something, the saint, three saints at something Virgin Mary, I believe. Similar plays, chiefly from the Old Testament, were occasionally performed in Moscow too, up to the times of Peter the Great. But besides plays, there were all sorts of legends and ballads scattered about the world, in which the saints and angels and all the powers of heaven took part when required. In our monasteries, the monks busied themselves in translating, copying, and even composing such poems, and even under the Tatars. There is, for instance, one such poem, of course from the Greek, The Wanderings of Our Lady Through Hell, which with descriptions as bold as Dante's. Our Lady visits hell, and the archangel Michael, Michael, leads her through the torments. She sees the sinners and their punishments. There she sees, among others, one noteworthy set of sinners in a burning lake. Some of them sink to the bottom of the lake so that they can't swim out, and these God forgets. An expression of extraordinary depth and force. And so Our Lady, shocked and weeping, falls before the throne of God and begs for mercy for all in hell, for all she has seen there indiscriminately. Her conversation with God is immensely interesting. She beseeches him. She will not desist, and when God points to the hand and feet of her son, nailed to the cross, and asks, "How can I forgive his tormentors?" she bids all the saints, all the martyrs, all the angels, all the archangels to fall down with her and pray for mercy on all without distinction. It ends by her winning from God a respite of suffering every year from Good Friday till Trinity Day, and the sinners at once raise a cry of thankfulness from hell, chanting, "Thou art just, O Lord, in this judgment." Well, my poem would have been of that kind if it had appeared at that time. He comes on the scene in my poem, but he says nothing. only appears and passes on. 15 centuries have passed since he promised to come in his glory. 15 centuries since his prophet rose. Behold, I come quickly. Of that day and that hour knoweth no man, neither the Son but the Father, as he himself predicted on earth. But humanity awaits him with the same faith, and with the same love. Oh, with greater faith, for it is 15 centuries since man has ceased to see signs from heaven. No signs from heaven come today, to add to what the heart doth say. There was nothing left but faith in what the heart doth say. It is true that there were many miracles in those days. There were saints who performed miraculous cures. Some holy people, according to their biographies, were visited by the Queen of Heaven herself. But the devil did not slumber, and doubts were already arising among men of the truth of these miracles. And just when there appeared in the north of Germany a terrible new heresy, a huge star like a torch, that is, to a church, fell on the sources of the waters, and they became bitter. These heretics began blasphemously denying miracles, but those who remained faithful were all the more ardent in their faith. The tears of humanity rose up to him as before, awaiting his coming, loved him, hoped for him, yearned to suffer and die for him, as before, and so many ages mankind had prayed with faith and fervor, O Lord, our God, hasten thy coming. So many ages called upon him. That is his infinite mercy. He deigned to come down to his servants before that day he had come down. He had visited some holy men, martyrs and hermits, as is written in their lives, among us. Tchutchev, with absolute faith in the truth of his words, bore witness that, bearing the cross in slavish dress, weary and worn, the heavenly King, our mother Russia, come to bless, and through our land went wandering. And that certainly was so, I assure you. And behold, he deigned to appear for a moment to the people, to the tortured, suffering people, sunk in iniquity. But, loving him like children, my story is laid in Spain, in Seville, in the most terrible time of the Inquisition, when fires were lighted every day to the glory of God, and in the splendid auto da fe, the wicked heretics were burnt. Of course, this was not the coming in which he will appear, according to his promise, at the end of time in all his heavenly glory, and which will be suddenly as lightning flashes from east to west. No, he visited children, his children, only for a moment, and there where the flames were crackling round the heretics. In his infinite mercy he came once more among men in that human shape, in which he walked among men for 33 years, 15 centuries ago. He came down to the hot pavements of the southern town, in which, on the day before, almost 100 heretics had ad majorem gloriam Dei been burnt by the Cardinal, the Grand Inquisitor, in a magnificent auto da fe, in the presence of the King, the Court, the Knights, the Cardinals, the most charming ladies of the Court, and the whole population of Seville. He came softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him. That might be one of the best passages in the poem. I mean, why they recognized him. The people are irresistibly drawn to him. They surround him. They flock about him, follow him. He moves silently in their midst with a gentle smile of infinite compassion. The sun of love burns in his heart. The power shines from his eyes, and their radiance shed on the people stirs their hearts with responsive love. He holds out his hands to bless them, blesses them, and a healing virtue comes from that contact with him, even with his garments. An old man in the crowd, blind from childhood, cries out, O Lord, heal me, and I shall see thee. And as it were, scales fall from his eyes, and the blind man sees him. The crowd weeps and kisses the earth under his feet. Children throw flowers before him, sing and cry, Hosanna! It is he, it is he. Repeat, it must be he. It can be no one but him. He stops at the steps of the Seville Cathedral at the moment when the weeping mourners are bringing in a little open white coffin. In it lies a child of 7, the only daughter of a prominent citizen. The dead child lies hidden in flowers. He will rise, your child. The crowd shouts to the weeping mother. The priest, coming to meet the coffin, looks perplexed and frowns, but the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet with a wail. "If it is thou, raise my child," she cries, holding out her hands to him. The procession halts, the coffin is laid on the steps at his feet. He looks with compassion, and his lips once more softly pronounce, "Maiden, arise," and the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in the coffin and looks around, smiling with wide, wondering eyes, holding a bunch of white roses they had put in her hand. There are cries and sobs, confusion among the people, and at that moment the cardinal himself, the Grand Inquisitor, passes by the cathedral. He is an old man, almost 90, tall and erect, with a withered face and sunken eyes, in which there is still a gleam of light. He is not dressed in his gorgeous cardinal's robes, as he was the day before when he was burning the enemies of the Roman Church. At this moment he is wearing the coarse, old monk's cassock. At a distance behind him come his gloomy assistants and slaves and the holy guard. He stops at the side of the crown and watches it from a distance. He sees everything. He sees them set the coffin down at his feet, sees the child rise up, and his face darkens. He knits his thick grey brows, and his eyes gleam with a sinister fire. He holds out his finger and bids the guard take him, and such is his power, so completely are the people cowed into submission and trembling obedience to him, that the crowd immediately makes way for him, for the guards, and in the midst of death-like silence they lay hands on him and lead him away. The crowd instantly bows down to the earth, like one man, before the old inquisitor. He blesses the people in silence and passes on. The guards lead their prisoner to the close, gloomy, vaulted prison in the ancient palace of the Holy Inquisition, and shut him in it. The day passes and is followed by the dark, burning, breathless night of Seville. The air is fragrant with laurel and lemon. In the pitch darkness, the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened, and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone. The door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway for a minute or two and gazes into his face. At last he goes up slowly, sets the light on the table and speaks, "Is it thou, thou?" but receives no answer. He adds at once, "Don't answer, be silent. What canst thou say, indeed? I know too well what thou wouldest say, and thou hast no right to add anything to what thou hadst said of old. Why then art thou come to hinder us? For thou hast come to hinder us, and thou knowest that. But dost thou know what will be tomorrow? I know not who thou art, and care not to know whether it is thou, or only a semblance of him. But tomorrow I shall condemn thee and burn thee at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people who have today kissed thy feet, tomorrow at the faintest sight from me will rush to heap up the embers of the fire. Knowest thou that? Yes, maybe thou knowest it," he added with a thoughtful penetration, never for a moment taking his eyes off the prisoner. "I don't quite understand, Ivan. Could you repeat that?" "What does it mean?" says Alyosha. "Really, he just spoke for 10 minutes straight, and you're just going to say, I don't understand. Could you repeat that, Ivan? Can you just go from the top?" All right, guys. I'm just going to scroll back up 5 pages here and go from the top. No one talks like that. No one just talks for 10 minutes straight to their friend, to their brother. Like, you know when you're like talking to someone and you like make eye contact while you're having a conversation, but if what they're saying goes for a little bit too long, then it can start to feel awkward to just like be looking at their eye for like, you know, 20 seconds. And so you like look elsewhere, like you might kind of drop your gaze or like busy yourself with something. What are they just looking in each other's eyes for like 10 minutes straight while one brother just talks and the other, what is Alyosha doing while his brother is just reading a book to him from his brain? It's so weird. It's so weird. This is the weirdest book. I feel like I'm crazy. I'm the only person who can see how bad this is. Sorry, mid reading rant. Let me get back to the book, hey? Let me continue here. He really did say, though, "I don't understand, Ivan. What does it mean?" Alyosha, who had been listening in silence, said with a smile, "Is it simply a wild fantasy or a mistake on the part of the old man? Some impossible quid pro quo?" take it as the last, said Ivan, laughing. If you are so corrupted by modern realism and can't stand anything fantastic, if you like it to be a case of mistaken identity, let it be so. It is true, he went on, laughing. The old man was 90, and he might well be crazy over his set idea. He might have been struck by the appearance of the prisoner. It might, in fact, be simply his ravings, the delusion of an old man of 90, overexcited by the auto de fa of 100 heretics the day before. But does it matter to us, after all, whether it was a mistake or of identity or a wild fantasy? All that really matters is that the old man should speak out, that he should speak openly of what he has thought in silence for 90 years. And the prisoner, too, is silent? Does he look at him and not say a word? That's inevitable in any case, Ivan laughed again. The old man has told him he hasn't the right to add anything to what he has said to of old. One may say it is the most fundamental feature of Roman Catholicism, in my opinion at least. All has been given by thee to the Pope, they say, and all, therefore, is still in the Pope's hands, and there is no need for thee to come now at all. Thou must not meddle for the time, at least. That's how they speak and write, too, the Jesuits, at any rate. I have read it myself in the works of their theologians. Hast thou the right to reveal to us one of the mysteries of the world, that from which thou hast come? My old man asks him, and answers the question for him. No, thou hast not, that thou mayest not add to what has been said of old, and mayest not take from the men the freedom which thou didst exalt when thou wast on earth. Whatsoever thou revealest anew will encroach of men's freedoms of faith, for it will be manifest as a miracle, and the freedom of their faith was dearer to thee than anything in those days 1500 years ago. Didst thou not often say, I will make you free? But now thou hast seen thee free, men, the old man adds suddenly, with a pensive smile. Yes, we've paid dearly for it, he goes on, looking sternly at him. But at last we have completed that work in thy name. For 15 centuries we have been wrestling with thy freedom, but now it is ended and over for good. Dost thou not believe that it's over for good? Thou lookest meekly at me, and deignest not even to be wroth with me. But let me tell thee thou that thou today people are more persuaded than ever that they have perfect freedom. Yet they have brought their freedom to us and laid it humbly at our feet. But that has been our doing. But that, but this, but that, but this. Was this what thou didst? Was this thy freedom? I don't understand again, Alyosha broke in. Again, Alyosha, come on, pay attention, buddy. Is he ironical? Is he jesting? No, not a bit of it. He claims it as a merit for himself and his church that at last they have vanquished freedom and have done so to make men happy. For now, he is speaking of the Inquisition, of course. For the first time it has become possible to think of the happiness of men. Man was created a rebel, and how can rebels be happy? Thou wast warned, he says to him, thou hast had no lack of admonitions and warnings, and thou didst not listen to those warnings. Thou didst reject the only way by which men might be made happy. But, fortunately, departing, thou didst hand on the work to us. Thou hast promised, thou hast established by thy word, thou hast given to us the right to bind and to unbind, and now, of course, thou canst not think of taking it away. Why then hast thou come to hinder us? And what is the meaning of no lack of admonitions and warnings? Asked Alyosha. Why, that's the chief part of what the old man must say, the wise and dread spirit, the spirit of self-destruction and non-existence. The old man goes on, great spirit talked with thee in the wilderness, and we are told in the books that he tempted thee. Is that so? And could anything truer be said than what he revealed to thee in 3 questions, and what thou didst reject, and what in the books is called the temptation? And yet, if there has ever been on earth a real stupendous miracle, It took place on that day, on the day of the three temptations. The statement of those three questions was itself the miracle. If it were possible, to imagine simply for the sake of argument, for argument's sake, okay, that those three questions of the dread spirit had perished utterly from the books, and that we had to restore them and to invent them anew, and to do so had gathered together all the wise men of the earth, rulers, chiefs, priests, learned men, philosophers, poets, etc., and had them the task to invent three questions such as would not only fit the occasion but express in three words, three human phrases, the whole future history of the world and of humanity, dost thou believe that all the wisdom of the earth united could have invented anything in depth and force equal to the three questions which were actually put to thee then by the wise and mighty spirit in the wilderness? From those questions alone, from the miracle of their statement, we can see that we have here to do not with the fleeting human intelligence, but with the absolute and eternal. For in those three questions, the whole subsequent history of mankind is, as it were, brought together into one whole, and foretold in them are united all the unsolved historical contradictions of human nature. At the time it could not be so clear, since the future was unknown, but now that 1500 years have passed, we see that everything in those three questions was justly divined and foretold, and has been so truly fulfilled, that nothing can be added to them or taken from them. What are these three questions? Did I miss something? They sound like great questions. Judge thyself who was right, thou or he who questioned thee then. Remember the first question, its meaning, in other words, was this. Thou wouldest go into the world and art going with empty hands, with some promise of freedom which men in their simplicity and their natural unruliness cannot even understand, which they fear and dread, for nothing has ever been more insupportable for a man and a human society than freedom. Is that a question? That's not a question. But seest thou these stones in this parched and barren wilderness? Is that the question? Are you asking if I see stones in parched and barren wilderness? Turn them into bread, and mankind will run after thee like a flock of sheep, grateful and obedient, though for ever trembling, lest thou withdraw thy hand and deny them thy bread. But thou wouldest not deprive man of freedom, and didst reject the offer, thinking, what is that freedom worth if obedience is bought with bread? Thou didst reply that man lives not by bread alone, but dost thou know that for the sake of that earthly bread, the spirit of the earth will rise up against thee and will strive with thee and overcome thee, and all will follow him, crying, who can compare with this beast? He has given us fire from heaven. Dost thou know that the ages will pass and humanity will proclaim by the lips of their sages that there is no crime and therefore no sin, there is only hunger? Feed men, and then ask them of them virtue. That's what they'll write on the banner. Look at banner, which they will rise against thee, and with which they will destroy thy temple. Where thy temple stood will rise a new building. The terrible Tower of Babel will be built again, and though like the one of old, it will be not finished yet, thou mightest have prevented that new tower, and have cut short the sufferings of men for thousands of years, for they will come back to us after 1,000 years of agony with their tower. They will seek us again, hidden underground in the catacombs, for we shall be again persecuted and tortured. They will find us and cry to us, feed us, for those who have promised us fire from heaven haven't given it. And then we shall finish building their tower, for he finishes the building who feeds them. And we alone shall feed them in thy name, declaring falsely that it is in thy name. Oh, never, never can they feed themselves without us. No science will give them bread so long as they remain free. In the end, they will lay their freedom at our feet and say to us, make us your slaves, but feed us. They will understand themselves at last that freedom and bread enough for all are inconceivable together, for never, never will they be able to share between them. They will be convinced, too, that they can never be free, for they are weak and vicious, worthless and rebellious. Thou didst promise them the bread of heaven. But, I repeat again, can it compare with earthly bread in the eyes of the weak, ever sinful and ignoble race of man? And if for the sake of the bread of heaven thousands shall follow thee, what is to become of the millions and tens of thousands of millions of creatures who will not have the strength to forego the earthly bread for the sake of the heavenly? Or dost thou care only for the tens of thousands of the great and strong, while the millions numerous as the sands of the sea, who are weak but love thee, must exist only for the sake of the great and strong? No, we care for the weak too. They are sinful and rebellious, but in the end they too will become obedient. They will marvel at us and look on us as gods, because we are ready to endure the freedom which they have found so dreadful, and to rule over them. So awful it will seem to them to be free. But we shall tell them that we are thy servants, and rule them in thy name. We shall deceive them again, for we will not let thee come to us again. That deception will be our suffering, for we shall be forced to lie. Alright, that is the first half of this chapter. We're going to stop it there. Holy moly, that was a mouthful. That was a lot of words. A lot of words in that one. Wordy book. Good old wordy book. Thanks for listening to that. Have your say about it over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I appreciate you guys being here. And I'll see you tomorrow.